Welcome to I'm a Perfectionist, Get Me Out of Here, where we are all allowed to be perfectly imperfect. My guests and I, we explore the different areas of perfectionism and how it has been affecting them. We also share some tips and techniques that will help everyone overcome their issues with perfectionism. Hello, all the imperfectly perfect listeners. I hope you have been enjoying the past 25 episodes where we have been having amazing guests who came with their insights on their own perfectionism and how it affected their lives. I thought perhaps it would be a really good thing that you get to know me, my story. So this story comes from Istanbul, moved to Denmark for 13 years, where I also had my daughter, and then moved to London and started working in television. Just thinking about what brought me to right here and right now, that built up helping thousands of people overcome their anxiety, overcome their fears. I have been interviewed by Ali Swift from Take a Seat, and here we go.
Hello, it is time to take a seat with me, Ali Swift, and taking a seat with me today is Aileen Webb. Psychologist and lecturer Aileen is an anxiety mastery coach, perfectionism specialist, CBT and EDMR therapist, speaker, and podcast host of I'm a Perfectionist, Get Me Out of Here. Over the past decade, Aileen has helped thousands of people overcome their anxiety caused by fear of failure and judgment so that they can build their confidence and feel more empowered to live happier lives. Well, hello, Aileen. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me here, Ali.
Let me just double check. I am saying your name correctly, aren't I?
Aileen is, yes. Aileen,
yeah. Aileen, and I also realised then I said EDMR and it's EMDR. I did. We actually had that conversation about how everyone gets it wrong.
I'm gonna tell you later.
Did it there and then. So prior to this episode, we had a chat and I am really looking forward to this conversation today. You have got such a colourful you've had such a colourful life and you continue to do so. Your experiences and your knowledge are going to really empower our audience, I do believe. So I am actually going to start by asking you to take us back to Istanbul, which is where it all began, and just share more about why you got to where you've got to and do the work that you do to help others.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ali. And firstly, really, thank you for having me. And what a great podcast you've got here.
Amazing.
It's really wonderful. So going back to Istanbul, gosh, it's like a lifetime away, which it is really. So I was born and raised in Istanbul, and it was just what you're used to. When you don't know anything differently, you think everything, the mess, the traffic, the dirt, dirty streets and everything is normal. But Istanbul is a beautiful city. When you just look at the right things, it's got an amazing history. And I used to go to school on the other side, on the Asian side, and live on the European side. And just every day crossing that bridge and looking at all those amazing buildings always took my breath away. Looking at the sea with all the boats always took my breath away. So Istanbul is beautiful. I love Istanbul. And I think everyone that visits the city would agree. So the only problem I used to have in Istanbul, I had amazing friends, my family, really modern. My dad was a technical manager at IBM. So he used to travel to Europe, to America, and sometimes we went with him. We lived in Belgium as well. So really modern family, but outside there's a mixture story. outside is different. So when you leave home and you get on a bus or you walk at the street, men are almost abusive. You know, the builders here sometimes at the street, they can tell things like, and whatever.
The wolf whistle culture.
A lot more that when I was younger, and I'm talking about before the first bridge, when I was born, there were no bridges in Istanbul. We used to just cross by the boat. So that is how dinosaur years I'm from. And anyway, so they would touch you on the bus, and it was just, there was just this general subconscious idea that they were somehow better than women and they could just do whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the whole, you know, I'm not generalizing, but there was a lot of it as I was growing up. Girls now, a lot.
That was your norm. That was what you knew.
Yeah, that was, but it was really annoying. And as I grew up and became to my teenage years, there were a lot of things I did not like, especially about how the women were treated and about some disagreements that I had with other women, how they suppressed themselves as well. But of course, it's about their belief. And I can see that now, that's their normal and that's how they grew up. But at that time, I was quite one-sided and I used to be quite judgmental and see, how can they let this happen to them? Mm-hmm. How can they just knowingly walk 3 meters behind men and so on? And so I think from almost when I was born, I was really against that inequality. Mm-hmm. It was really important for me. And I think it was really deep, even though I was a child, I was a teenager. I felt it. Maybe I could not quite put a finger on it. And I didn't quite know how to understand those women either. Or the men, but I still see it today. I go to Turkey, but I have to say I have learned a bit. So if there is a man in anywhere and he is perhaps being abusive, I call my brother. And then they step back. It's interesting, isn't it? If I am saying something, if I say, no, you cannot come in front of me in this queue, whatever, then they start shouting at me as if it's their right. Mm-hmm. But then I ask my brother, can you please come? And if he's nearby, he will come and the men will just back off. That's so interesting when I'm down there, isn't it? Men back off from each other, but with women, they are not like that.
And that's still happening today, isn't it? That's the reality of it.
I can tell, last year, several things happened. So I was there for a few months because my father passed away and there was COVID, so I couldn't come back. And I had to deal with a lot of bureaucracy, paperwork, and so on. And that's where I understood, not much has changed, unfortunately. So that has, I think, been very deep inside me, that I probably from early ages and my teenagers knew that this was not how I want to live either. But again, I'll say this is not general. There are some, you know, an amazing amount of people who are modern, who are very respectful, who would never think about any difference between men and women at all. And that's, you know, that's the way I grew up as well. That's how my father was. And that's everyone we know around us as well. Many of us have been empowered by our fathers.
Mm-hmm. And so you actually left Istanbul, didn't you? And you set a life up in Copenhagen.
That's right. And that's a complete coincidence. I went to, I don't know if you heard of it, there was Interrail traveling back in the 80s.
Yeah, I have so heard of it.
Backpacking, my very good friend and I, she now lives in Australia, She used to be head of L'Oreal. So at that time, we were 18, and complete surprise to us that our fathers actually allowed us to do this, because we didn't think that we would be allowed. But our fathers were like, okay, go out there and practice your English, practice. She used to speak French, so practice your French, just get out there and experience the world. So that was amazing, the two of us just getting on the train to travel around Europe. And I remember at the border, the man who checks our passports as we were leaving Turkey, he came and started speaking English to us. And we said, oh, you're Turkish. He's like, what? How did your fathers leave you to go traveling? But he wasn't surprised if they were foreign, but he was surprised because we were two Turkish girls mm-hmm. going traveling. Anyway, on that trip, I actually met my husband then, who was Danish, and who was also the father of my daughter. And I moved to Copenhagen, we got married. And and that's then a completely different story than it's the story in Copenhagen in Denmark. Yeah.
So in Copenhagen in Denmark, though, you actually had other cultural challenges, didn't you?
Yes. Now, I have to say, once I came to Copenhagen, I loved it. It was really peaceful and not chaotic at all. And no one cared about what the other person did. I was used to everyone checking up, opening the doors, looking through curtains to see what time we come home. Are we good girls? Do we have any guys coming with us or anything? Which was obviously unthinkable. You would never bring a guy home, even if it's your friend. That would be being a bad girl, because they wouldn't know what you're doing in your house. So there were no eyes on me. And it was just such a freedom. And I thought, yes, that's how it should be. And also I had my challenges, of course, by looking different. I don't know, I was looking at my pictures from then. My hair then is pitch black and brown eyes and darker skin. I don't know what happened to me living in Europe, maybe just light and no sun. But but of course I look different to Danes, and I did mm-hmm. have a couple of challenges. And not knowing the language, I guess then you often have to work behind the scenes. So I was working in McDonald's, for example. I almost couldn't even get a job in McDonald's because I didn't speak Danish.
Yeah.
And Danish is not an easy language to learn. So it took me about 2 years. And even when I learned it, the best job I could get then was be chambermaid at a really good hotel. So, but then we had lots of rock groups coming, so I got lots of free tickets to concerts, so, like Genesis and Brian Ferry and so on. I met them, so it had some fun attached to it anyway. And then luckily, I got an office job. And to be honest, at that point, I didn't care what it was. But it was an office job. I didn't have to do cleaning and just go up and down the stairs. I was supervisor by then, so that I was covering a lot of ground. And I had my baby in between. So I got an office job at TNT, and I think that was wonderful. I had lots of wonderful friends there. We were all same age, similar age group. We all had about kids around same age, so we were socializing outside work as well. So my TNT years were good. And then I moved to Turkish travel agency, where I could then, you know, work there as a Turkish person. And some Danes used to ask me, why are you here? when you have Turkey, you know, because they love traveling. Some of them love traveling to Turkey. Now, I'm talking about 35 years ago or more. And at that time, many Danes had not been to Turkey yet. And if you haven't been to a place and haven't seen something, then you have got preconceptions, judgments yeah. about places. So they used to think, I mean, not you, all of them, again, I won't generalize, but there was a generalized idea that there were camels walking around in Istanbul. And even somebody actually teased my husband then, asking, oh, how many camels did you have to pay for her?
Right.
And I remember that was not good for him because, it started an argument. So, and Danes don't argue very much. And yes, there has been a few incidents where I was just by anger told to go home. But I think that I did the best I could growth-wise in Denmark. I studied as well. So I studied transportation law, which the company has paid for. I was promoted looking after insurance cases. So yeah, it was all good, but something's still missing.
Something was missing. And that's what led you to London.
Yes, that's right.
Then you took on a completely different career.
Yeah, I was trying to get to London because I think that, you know, when the space, the cage is too small for you and you have grown out of it, you start pushing it and it starts becoming disturbing if you actually can't crush through it. And I started doing different things. I was actually applying for a green card in America. I was applying for jobs at TNT in London. And I actually I was working in TNT Copenhagen. And I called TNT London and I said, I will personally come and bring my CV if that would be okay. And I went to, I think it was in Canary Wharf then. I went all the way there. I went to their reception and asked for the person. And she wouldn't even come out. She did not, she just sent some assistant or somebody to pick up my, I just thought it's always different with just saying hello to each other, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why I made my way all the way there to meet this person. But they couldn't be bothered. And I'm actually looking back thinking, would I really want to work with that culture?
Yeah.
I think it's unkind. Anyway, they knew I was coming from Copenhagen to deliver this. But I didn't, obviously, needless to say, I didn't get anything at TNT. But I was still looking for options. And I know it was going to happen because once you make a decision, you start looking for all the options around it that will make it possible. And in between, my sister was living here and her husband was English. And she was looking at Guardian. At that time, media advertisements were always on Guardian. And she found this tiny little advertisement saying that they're looking for production coordinator who speaks Danish. So I said to my sister, but I know nothing about television. She said, yeah, but you speak Danish. She said, what is the worst thing? They can just say no. So I applied for it. And I was called for an interview. Then by then I was working for FedEx, which was small. It had just started up. And I was told that I couldn't take the day off because there were not enough people. And I said, I'm sorry, but I'll have to go. But then I'm not telling them what I'm going to do with that day, obviously. But I will never forget, thankfully, a friend of mine, again, who works there, Dan, he said, I will take your shift. I'll come. I have a day off, but I'll come for you. So he took my shift and I came to London, had a talk. They said, we will let you know. Then I had another talk in Copenhagen with TV3. And they said, there's only two of you. We will let you know. And then I didn't get the job. And I was so close. So, and I think by then I'm like, oh, I'm getting depressed now because this is not the life I want. I want more. So I moved house, spent a lot of money just to have some fresh again, fresh start, at least in another flat or a house. So just as I settled in my new flat, the phone rang and TV3 said, well, the other person we employed found something else, so he's not coming. And if you like, the job is yours.
Amazing.
So here I am, started working in TV3 and never looked back. My daughter came a year later because I had to settle down before I could bring my child here in a different country and see if I can make it work to start with, mm-hmm. because our department closed after 3 months. So I had no job after 3 months.
So you then have this amazing career in TV, do some a lot of exciting things. And something then happened though, didn't it, in your 40s, where you decided, I want to change my career. So let's explore now. Let's bring this to the present day.
Fast forward. Yes.
To, you know, why you really do what you do now. Because I think you've got such a colourful life and you've done so many incredible things. And one of the things that really jumped out at me was that you're never too young to become a psychologist. You're never too young to change your career. And I think that is one of the key messages that we can get from today because of all the things you've done, but also because of the suppression that you did experience as a child, a teenager, as a young woman, leaving your home country. You then went to Copenhagen where, let's call a spade, you did suffer racism. You know, you did have those cultural challenges and you learned so much more from that. You then moved to London. Your television career has been so colourful, but again, you've had the challenges through it. Then you hit your 40s. So take us now as to what led you to actually become a psychologist.
Yeah. So when you're working full time, especially in television, and as a single mom, it is challenging because there is guilt and then there is work and sometimes you have to finish things. By then your child is alone at home and so on. So it's got a lot of challenges. And psychology was always at the back of my mind. I would call Birkbeck College, check how much they charge and when do you have to be there. And for evening classes, I would think, what am I going to do with my daughter? So there was always those excuses, perhaps, or maybe I was just not ready. But one day, my daughter by then was also older. I was at work in Disney and I saw this lady in her 40s who was running around extremely stressed. And I could see that she was really, I'm not sure how to call it, but she was unhappy and stressed out. And there were too many things for her going on that she had to pull the strings off. And I thought, I don't want to do this in my 50s. I don't want to do this until I retire.
Yeah.
And so I started looking into studying psychology a lot more.
I guess following your passion.
Exactly.
Because it was something that intrigued you and you were fascinated by.
Yeah. And I hear, you know, a lot of people saying, oh, I've always been fascinated by psychology, always wanted to. But there is a point where you just, if it's really your passion, you just go, right, okay, I'm going to go for this now because life is so short. If I start now, at least in 7 years, I'll be finished. Let's just see how many years it takes. And I was not in a hurry. I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do this around my life. And year after year, suddenly I graduated. And then I thought, right, okay, so let's do, I actually did it as I usually do, backwards. So I did my master's first. And then I made a decision that, yes, I do want to help people, that I do want to resolve their issues, help them resolve their issues so that they can have a fulfilling life, the life they deserve. So that we can shift the mind that is in the way mm-hmm. of how they can live their life to the full. And I have, because I lived that myself, I have started twice, went from Turkey to Denmark and Denmark to London and made it happen just with the power of my mind. Nothing else, really, nothing else. So it was just, right, this is what I'm going to do. And it was the same when I met Bianca's dad. Yeah, we were both so determined that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Nothing could stand in the way. And we did make it happen. When I came to England, I was alone. We had divorced by then. So Bianca stayed with him and I settled down, bought a flat after a year. And then I could have Bianca to come here and live with me. And she still does. And she is happily married and have a baby herself. So her story has changed as well, of course, compared mm-hmm. to if she had stayed in yeah. Denmark, perhaps. Now, it took about 10 years to finish all the studies. And I have to say, there was a point where I had to let go of television and really, really focus on starting to make money as a therapist, because it's difficult to let go of something that makes your living and then start from, you know.
It's like a starting again, isn't it, in a lot of ways? And it's at what point do you make that break? I've been there myself. You know, you have this career in something that's actually given you stability. It's given you a good income. But the thing that you really want to do, you've got to, it's like starting again, starting afresh. And it is really challenging, but you've persevered with it though, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. So especially in the beginning, you know, you have to fill the certain hours to get your accreditation. It's all volunteer work. So no one thinks that you have to pay bills. So, yes, it did happen. And it was the best thing I did in my life. Every day I feel fulfilled. I love my clients, each and every one of them. And I love working with them and use the tools and pass them on and see when they realize, things where they go, oh, that's some of the best
light bulb moments. It's those light bulb moments, isn't it? Yeah. They're powerful. And you know that when they have those light bulb moments, you just want to fast forward to 12 months time and just see the change that will happen because of that moment.
I love it. Yeah.
You mentioned tools there. I love talking tools. And one of the power tools that you have as a therapist, and I'd want to dig deeper into this one because I'm fascinated by it. I've received this treatment. Can you tell us a little bit more about EMDR?
Yeah.
Which is eye movement.
Desensitization.
That word. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
EMDR.
It is a mouthful, isn't it? Even the shortened version of it is a mouthful.
Yeah.
I love EMDR. I think it does wonders. It really does.
So can you just explain what it is?
Sure. Now, when you have experienced something traumatic, and people think that a traumatic event is perhaps a traffic accident or when you have been to war or something really big. No, traumatic event can be anything that was unexpected and caused perhaps shame, guilt, a situation that affected the way you feel about yourself. For example, I was traumatized when I was 7 in front of the class when I was, put by the blackboard and asked to resolve a maths problem, which I couldn't. And I was looking at about 30 kids and my teacher was angry with me. I went into complete standing meltdown. And I know that that was my first anxiety attack there. And I was traumatized, mm-hmm. no doubt about it. So trauma can be smaller things as well. Anything that gets stored, we have three parts to our brain, roughly. So you have the cortex, where your thinking is going, that's your new brain, the curly part. Then you have the limbic brain, that's where all your emotions are stored with related memories as well. That's also where you have your amygdala and your fight or flight response happens.
Yeah.
The amygdala, the almond-shaped part that we have on both parts of the limbic brain. So then we have the reptile brain, where all the automated stuff happens, breathing, heartbeats, digestion and everything. You don't have to think about it. It just mm-hmm. happens. Now, the problem is in your limbic brain, you get this memory restored alongside with the smells, with so you have the memory with attached emotions, the smells, and so on, and visuals. So if you had an accident, for example, as soon as you go to that place, the emotions, the panic, the anxiety gets triggered. But that happens in a different part of your brain than the cortex, where you know it's happened. It's in the past. But those two parts don't connect. They are different in different parts of your brain. So EMDR actually makes new connections and finds new solutions to old problems. So it helps making new neural connections in your brain and integrates those two parts. And how it's usually you will have that you talk about, you are asked to recall this disturbing memory. And so you bring it to your working memory. And when it's in your working memory, you're asked then to find the worst picture that mm-hmm. represents this memory. And then you bring that up to your working memory and it's ready to be processed. So as you are moving your eyes, and which is also connected to our rapid eye movement, when we are sleeping towards the morning, we have our REM sleep, where we actually process all the emotions and the attached memories early hours in the morning. So things always look better when we wake up in the morning compared to if we were upset at night.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you're missing your REM sleep, if you actually are not sleeping well, so you're constantly for a long period of time missing that part of your sleep, that actually can start causing depression.
Right. Which is why there's such a link between sleep and depression.
Yes.
So I have actually had EMDR.
Yes. How was that?
I would say it was the thing that really did pull out that really deep rooted trauma that what happened is I was talking to a hypnotherapist. This was actually after I'd done a lot of my healing work, and I was interviewing a hypnotherapist, and I said, what really frustrates me is that no matter what happens or what goes on in my life, when I sit back in the therapist chair, this one specific event always comes up. And I'm like, how many times can I talk about this one specific event that happened when I was 7 years old? And she said, it's probably because you're not talking about the right thing. There's probably something else actually attached to that that you need to get out, but you don't necessarily know that it's there. So she offered to give me some hypnotherapy, and I had the hypnotherapy. She actually traced back to a memory when I was 3 years old, we released it. She made me feel safe in this situation. And she actually used the EMDR to effectively rewire my brain. And I was absolutely fascinated by it. But the other, there was a specific incident that happened to me when I was about 25 years old. It was very traumatic, involving a loved one. And I obviously hold resentment and anger because of what happened. But I thought, I've processed this. I've done all this in therapy. It's gone. Why is this coming up in my hypnotherapy session? And she asked me to go back to a memory where I felt very angry towards this person. And I wanted to tell them something different to what I told them at the time, because I was a real people pleaser. So she took me to this memory, which I've got to say was terrifying, because it was as if I was reliving. And I was in a relaxed state, but I remember thinking, I don't want to go here. Why am I going back to this? But I trusted the process. I went back to the memory. I relived it for a few moments. I wouldn't even say it was 2 minutes. It was very short. She brought me out of the memory. She then gave me EMDR. And I will come back to the fact that it was online in a minute. She gave me EMDR. And then she asked me to go back into the memory with my children. So I had to take my children, my precious babies, to that scary situation. And I remember thinking, I can't do this. I can't do this. Oh, I don't know. Something's flashing up on the screen. And I did it though. I followed the instruction. I went back into the memory. I took my children, and the fear and the anxiety and the anger and the resentment had gone, because it made me realize that my children were my priority now. That was the past that had gone. That wasn't a danger to me or my children anymore. I came back out of the memory, and then she gave me EMDR again. And I can honestly say that memory now, that was a real trigger for me, even nearly 20 years later, because I am 43 now, gone. I think about that memory now, and I nearly smile at that memory, because I know that I'm safe now. And that trauma, which was a major trigger for my post-traumatic stress disorder, it's gone, because my brain has literally been rewired. And I just find it incredible. Yeah. It's just incredible what you can do. But what's even more incredible, and I do want to cover this with you, is the fact it was online.
Hmm.
That you can do this online, can't you?
Yeah, it makes no difference.
Because she was literally shining this light into my eyes, and I was like putting my eyes up to the screen. And she was asking me to move my eyes side to side and using the light to help rewire my brain.
And you don't even have to use the light. You can do that as long as you connect right and left.
Mm-hmm.
There are tickers, so you have in your hands, so it goes right, left, right, left, right, left, or eyes, right, left, right, left, or ears, so you can have clickers, click, 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 or really good old days, tapping on your knees. Tapping on your knees, because sometimes my clients are on their phones, so there isn't much space to follow right and left.
Yeah,
on your phone. So this is normally what I use, or the butterfly, right, left, with your hands. But there are now, I mean, it is, what you're saying is amazing, because I see this happen day after day. Sometimes my clients are like, I say, okay, come on, call the image. Yeah, it's gone. And
yeah.
And they're like, what did you do? It's your brain that does everything. You don't do anything. Your brain does it.
Yeah. What fascinates me is just now recalling that memory, because obviously I'm doing it now because that's what my brain's naturally doing, because I've told the story. Mm-hmm. My children are there at what happened, but I was 25 years old. My children weren't born until my late 30s. They weren't there, but my brain now really believes that they were there. And it's just incredible. And this is why I'm so passionate about having these conversations, because a lot of people don't know that some of these these quite incredible tools exist.
That's right.
And they work alongside, don't they? So something with like EMDR, you wouldn't necessarily have that on its own. That works alongside psychotherapy or hypnotherapy. Is that right?
Well, sometimes you just do EMDR.
Oh, okay.
But knowing CBT, I think, is really helpful. I mean, firstly, my supervisor from university, Amanda, she really encouraged me to learn about EMDR. So already when I did CBT accreditation, I was getting my qualification for EMDR as well. So I've been doing it for a really long time. And I think many people, they hear about it, they're like, oh, I heard this EMDR. But when they come to me, for example, I had a client with needle phobia.
Right.
He had tried everything. He tried CBT. He tried, all sorts of different types of therapy and hypnotherapy. And he said, I heard about EMDR, and this is my last hope, because otherwise I won't be able to get my COVID vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terrified, he said, and I have been for 56 years, he said. So I don't have my hopes up, but let's see what this can do. And so when you're doing your assessment, you use a lot of CBT, because CBT is all about a situation, thoughts, beliefs that are limiting you and triggering emotions and your behavior. So I think knowing that, you can go straight to to what's going on with those beliefs and do an overall assessment. But then, you know, that's a part of EMDR as well.
Yeah.
So you do your assessment and then you go straight into EMDR. And I'm glad to say that we had just six sessions. He had his first vaccination. He had his second, his third. He got back to me after his third as well. And he said, I can't believe, I just never thought this would happen. So again,
so is that him now? Is that him healed from that trauma?
He's got no problem anymore.
And did you actually get to the root of that trauma? Because I'm guessing it would have been something to do with those first vaccinations when he was born.
It did, but to be honest with you, we worked a lot on forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, flash forward.
Oh, okay. Rather than back, you go forward.
Yeah. So we worked with some back, but there was not one single memory or something that started this trauma. So we worked backwards, and once it did not make any difference,
mm-hmm.
I then decided, okay, we are just going to go and see if we can prepare him for this. And by the time he actually went to the place to have the vaccination, he said, I had already been there in my mind over and over and over again, that it was like I was prepared. There was nothing that could scare me. I was prepared for the worst thing that could happen.
And this is it. It's incredible how you literally can rewire the brain through an hour, 6 hours. That, you know, you say six sessions, that's less than 6 hours, isn't it, of actual EMDR. And it actually can change your whole outlook on life. It can change the things you do. It can help you release your fears. And going back to that memory that she took me into when I was actually 3 years old, I remember I was in, she kind of really relaxed me. She was a hypnotherapist, so she really relaxed me. And she said, I want you to go into a memory where you blame yourself for something really bad that happened. And I was, you just go with the first thing that comes up. And I was all of a sudden in my grandparents' lounge. Now, to me, my grandparents' house was the safest place. I always felt so safe there. And I suddenly felt scared. And I didn't like the fact. I said to her, this is making me feel really uncomfortable, because this is a place where I always felt safe. I've never, ever felt unsafe in this house. She said, let's go with it. And I could feel my grandfather's brother in the room behind me, but I knew he wasn't alive. right? In this memory, I knew he wasn't alive, but he was behind me, which might sound strange. And the rest of the room, though, was black. I couldn't see anything, but I just knew everyone was really angry with me. And I got really scared and I got frightened. I got really upset. And I was saying, it's my fault. I know that this is all my fault. And she brings me back out. She gave me the MDR. She put me back into the memory and it had cleared and I felt safer. And when she came back out, I said, what happened? And she said, because I didn't actually recall what had happened. I just knew how I felt. I couldn't actually see what had happened. I didn't know why I felt that way. And she said, it doesn't matter. What you now know is back in that memory, whatever it is, you feel safe. And that's what she needed to achieve out of that session for me. And after, I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but after the session, I'm an overthinker, neurodivergent. I was like, I wonder what it was. I wonder what it was. And she did tell me not to overthink it, but I did actually contact one of my parents and said, what was, do you know what that was? What happened? And it was my dad actually I called. And he said, as soon as you started speaking, I knew exactly what memory that was. And he told me, it's very personal. He told me what had happened. And he said, I completely understand why you've held that on as a trauma, but it's gone. And again, it's just completely fascinating. Even if you don't remember the memory, body remembers the feeling. It will remember the smells. Mm. It's just, honestly, it blows my mind. My mind.
There are books about the body remembers. It does. Your body remembers.
The body keeps the score, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. And with the emotions, EMDR, what is really good about EMDR is that you can just work with the emotion.
Mm.
Yeah. You can let it take you back where you have started learning these things, where you first felt it, and you can actually just process the emotion. You don't necessarily need that image that I was talking about earlier in your working memory.
But it attaches.
You don't have to tell the therapist that you're working with. You know, normally you do a set and then you say a couple of sentences about what you see, what you get. But if in the worst cases, when the client is really worried about sharing it to start with, you can just keep it to yourself as well.
Yeah.
And you will still process it without talking about it.
But not only that, that memory was attached to so many other memories. And within one conversation with my dad, a lot of my life made sense. Oh, again, you have that light bulb moment. That's why I had that kind of relationship with that person. That's why I've blamed myself for these things throughout my life. That's why the death of other people make me take on responsibility, even though it's not anything to do with me. It was like this massive chain of events in my life was just gone and resolved. It was honestly, like, as I said before, it blows my mind.
Yeah. And the fantastic thing about it is really your brain does the healing.
Mm.
It does the work. So we specifically say, don't look for something and don't judge what comes up. Just allow your brain do the work and just tell me whatever comes up.
And again, it's intuition as well. A lot of it is, isn't it? It's just what naturally comes up. Don't overthink it. Don't try and force. The thing that needs to come up will come up.
Yeah.
So you're also a coach as well. Mm-hmm. And you love to coach mainly women, isn't it, around empowerment? Because let's go back to Istanbul and the experiences you had. And one of the things that really fascinated with me, and you touched on this a few times while you were talking at the start, was around your relationship with your father. So your dad sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And you spoke to me about, you know, you've been on a grieving journey yourself, but you're so grateful for the relationship you had with him because he empowered you in a country that actually was suppressed women. But you've taken so much from that relationship with him, so much from your learning as a woman growing up in Turkey. And now you are empowering others. So tell us a bit more about that.
Very passionate about empowering others, especially those who have been suppressed, those who have been stuck in perhaps relationships or feeling powerless. But know that there is more to it out there. You need to want it. You need to want that change. You need to kind of want to know, I want to grow. Yeah, I want more from my life. I want more fulfillment. And I definitely find a lot of, I think there is, even in this society, there is still power inequality.
Mm-hmm.
Not as obvious as some of the Eastern countries. And this is not as obvious as, for example, outside the cities in Turkey. But I have to say, it really depends on the tradition, the parts of Turkey. In some parts, you will find the mothers are the most powerful. In some mm-hmm. of the villages, you will find that the mothers are at the top. Yeah, of the
there
hierarchy.
Is a hierarchy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then the fathers are like, just ask your mom. But I'm just talking about in general how women are suppressed, and how young girls, if they're, it's interesting, isn't it, that it is the mothers who are bringing up their sons to suppress their gender. And we in the way that I see it here is often, again, I'm not saying everyone, but often the way mothers bring up their sons, looking after them and always doing everything for them, causes problem in their marriages, in their future relationships, because then those boys are used to everything being done for them, cooked and washed and pampered. And so when they get married, they think that it's the woman's job. So I still hear my clients, female clients, going, oh, you know, he's good at helping me. So this is so deeply rooted in us. Why is it helping? It's, you're sharing a life. Why do you call that helping?
It's
even us.
Yeah, so my husband, who I'm actually going through divorce at the moment, he's very hands-on, and he always has been. He we very much 50-50. But he doesn't, to be fair to him, he doesn't push this. But so, oh, you're so lucky he's so hands-on. You should be so grateful. And I'm like, well, what? Where does the equality come in if I'm the one that should be grateful because he's so hands-on? Is he grateful because I'm so hands-on? But this is, it's generational, it's cultural. It's so deep-rooted within all of us, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So deep-rooted. And actually, if you go against the grain, if you challenge these things, you're disruptive, you're loud, obnoxious, you know, you're criticized for having an opinion on this type of thing or trying to bring change to this type of conversation.
I mean, think about women who went out and asked for equal payment mm. for the same job that they were doing. I listened to a story with Oprah, where she, when she was, I can't remember the network, but when she was reading news with this guy and he was earning more and she was obviously earning less, yeah. but they were doing exactly the same job in front of the camera. And so she went to her boss and said, I want to be paid the same. And he said, well, do you have a mortgage? No. Are you married? No. Do you have children? No. Well, then you don't need to be paid more.
Wow.
So can you say, this is in this century.
Exactly. Okay. And this is why,
Oprah is still alive, you know, and this is in her adult years.
And these are the challenges we're facing, not just as women, though. There's you know, there's across all genders and non-gender, but also across cultures. We are facing so many different challenges around equality, and it is making people feel less empowered, but which is why we need the likes of Aline to do the amazing work that you're doing. We are actually coming towards the end of the podcast, to believe it or not. That nearly hour has flown so quickly. But one of the questions that I do like to ask all my guests, it's the only question that I really prepare, is with the work that you do, you give a lot. You give a lot of your energy to helping healing others and to helping others understand themselves. What do you do for you?
Yeah, you have to be really conscious about looking after yourself. You would know. But if you're especially passionate about what you're doing, you can find yourself, oh, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to do that. And if you don't, at a certain point, turn off everything, you can keep on and on and on to a point of burnout. So I normally notice if I'm going that way, because I feel a bit deflated and I have to take action straight away. But I also have to be aware of not to get there. If perfectionism is getting in the way of you living your life to the full, then check out my new book, Perfectly Imperfect, Cultivating Your Self-Worth in a Demanding World. It's based on cognitive behavioral principles and can help you work on yourself. There are some times where, for example, last week I had my book launch. So leading up to the book launch of Perfectly Imperfect, there were a lot of things to do. And because I had a deadline, I just had to keep going.
But yeah, you felt the pressure.
I knew that there was a deadline, but it was like just preparing everything until late, really, sometimes. But I go to the gym. And when I go to the gym, I go to the classes. So I'm not run on the machine it doesn't do much to me.
But classes are excellent. It's connection. You're not just exercising. And
exactly.
You're getting connection, lovely, which you know is the power of people.
Yoga, Pilates, I do swimming. And I always have certain days massage booked. And so no matter what, I work around those bookings of my massage,
you do have a self-care plan.
Absolutely.
In place.
Yeah.
We can't leave this podcast without talking about your book.
Oh.
So you've got to give us a quick download on Perfectly Imperfect.
Yes. So yes, of course, that book came about really of put all together all my experiences of my life. So there is a lot of perfectionism and how perfectionism works, how there's a little test about whether you're a perfectionist, and it looks into the CBT principles of perfectionism with all the related automatic thoughts and beliefs, behavior, emotions, and it looks into then mindfulness and authenticity, self-care, and so on, and looking into the secrets of happiness at the end chapter. And it has, as well as, I didn't want to write this for academics, it's for people. So it's not like, according to something et al and da da da. It's more just daily language entwined with my life. So there is a lot of me in there as well, and my experiences too. So it's like you and I talking. I'm kind of chatting away and also just putting the principles of CBT there as well. And then there's the transformation. That's transformation through the power of quotes. But I think, with Perfectly Imperfect, Cultivating Your Self-Worth in a Demanding World, because perfectionism is all about putting your self-worth in things, in your achievements. So I think I talk a lot about self-worth in there as well, and loving yourself and appreciating yourself.
And that is a really lovely way to round up such a lovely podcast. I really have enjoyed chatting with you, Aline. your experiences. Like, I felt bad really at the start because there's so much experience. Your TV career is so colourful. I know at one point you were a dancer for Disney. You were doing...
I think it put the seeds about helping women that I used to teach belly dancing.
That was it, yeah.
It wasn't for Disney, so I was producer by day, and in the evenings...
That is when you were working for Disney, you were doing that as well.
In the evenings as a hobby, yeah.
You really have had such a colourful life, and now you're taking all those experiences. You've applied, you know, it all into your hard work and your passion of psychology, and now you're empowering so many people to heal and to overcome their fears and to live a more positive life. So Perfectly Imperfect is your book. So if you are listening to this, then go and check that out. I guess it's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon. There are other books called Perfectly Imperfect. So this one has a subtitle, Cultivating Your Self-Worth in a Demanding World. But they can also just search my name, Aileen Webb, and all books come out.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time today. I've especially loved chatting to you about EMDR as well. And I said it right. I got it right.
EMDR,
I only said it wrong once.
It's such a big subject as well. I can't get enough of talking about EMDR either.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you for joining us in I'm a Perfectionist, Get Me Out of Here podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please do leave stars and a review. Help me spread the word by sharing this with your friends and family. My practical manual, Transformation Through the Power of Quotes, will help you or someone you know get through tough times and feel happier. It is now available on Amazon paperback and Kindle. You can also check out our website, mindandmood.co.uk. Thank you again, and remember, imperfect action is better than perfect inaction. Bye for now.